Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're taking a look at something really fascinating, Kurdish jewelry traditions. We've got a lot of research observations, and our aim is really to try and uncover the stories, the significance behind these beautiful adornments.
Yeah, and it's so much more than just decoration, isn't it? For Kurdish people, jewelry is, well, it's fundamental.
Right. It's about culture, identity, heritage.
Exactly. And you see this appreciation everywhere, you know? From simple silver coins or beads, right up to really elaborate gold, precious stones, even when times are tough.
So let's try and trace some of those historical threads. We'll be looking at the roots in places like ancient Mesopotamia, Anatolia.
And the influences from different empires too, Sasanian, Byzantine, Abbasid, Ottoman.
And how trade routes played a part, bringing in different materials for Kurdish artisans to work with.
It's true. Kurdistan's position, historically, it's always been a kind of crossroads. And you really see that reflected in the jewelry. It's this amazing mix of local creativity and, you know, outside influences shaping things over centuries, millennia even.
Okay, so where should we start? Maybe with the sheer variety, the different types of jewelry.
Sounds good. It's almost like a visual language.
Yeah. What about head adornments? Forehead ornaments seem quite common, often silver coins, sometimes gold leaf pendants.
And you have pieces like the Saba Uyun, the seven eyes.
Yes, with those distinctive blue faience discs for protection. Why blue faience specifically? What's the thinking there?
That's a great question. The blue faience pops up not just in Iraqi Kurdistan, but across Southwest Asia. It points to this really ancient, widespread belief in the protective power of the color blue. It was often linked to the sky, the heavens,
and
fought to ward off evil. So putting it in jewelry like the Saba Uyun was, well, both beautiful and protective, a dual purpose.
That makes a lot of sense. And then there are the decorated hats, like the Kilaw phase, especially in the Haramain region, I think.
Yes. Often adorned with coral or blue beads, sometimes gold beads, very distinctive.
And decorated headscarves, too, and the kofi. Some of those can be incredibly elaborate, right?
Yeah.
With golden drop coins, gems.
Absolutely stunning sometimes. And we shouldn't forget the sourcing, even if the sources are a bit lighter on detail about its specific jewelry elements.
How does the sourcing fit in, broadly speaking?
Well, even without all the specifics, we can probably infer it served similar functions, you know, indicating status, maybe marking life events, or just being part of traditional dress. The exact materials, the designs, would likely vary quite a bit by region, local styles, what materials were available, that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's move down to necklaces. There's a huge range here, too.
Oh, definitely.
You have the Gardana, often very richly decorated. Turquoise, coins, corals. I saw one example mentioned with coins from 1875.
Wow, yeah. That really gives you a sense of history.
And then the Jerchanaga. That's the one made entirely of coins, specifically for weddings.
That's right. Very ceremonial.
So what's the deal with all the coins? Why are they so prominent?
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Coins are a recurring theme. Beyond just looking good, they were, you know, a very practical form of wealth.
Portable wealth.
Exactly. Easy to carry, readily available. So a necklace loaded with coins wasn't just beautiful, it was a statement about the wearer's family's economic standing. And using coins from different times, like that 1875 example, it hints at trade, the flow of currency through the region.
Right.
And the Jerchanaga being specifically for weddings really highlights how important jewelry was in marriage customs, economically and socially.
Absolutely. And it's not just those specific types.
Yeah.
Coin necklaces seem widespread generally. Plus silver ones, beaded ones, yoke necklaces, pendant necklaces.
A huge variety.
Including modern ones, like pendants shaped like the map of Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And some really heavy traditional wedding necklaces.
It really shows the range, doesn't it? And that shift, you know, from purely traditional forms to incorporating symbols like the map.
Yep.
That's a powerful example of how jewelry adapts. It becomes a way to express current identities, a sense of belonging.
That's interesting. Let's not forget the smaller things, though. Earrings, bracelets, anklets, rings.
Right, the accents.
There's mention of large gold earrings and also small gold rings or nose rings, kazim. Or lutawana, often with turquoise?
Kazim or lutawana.
Was that just for the nose or?
Interestingly, those terms could apparently refer to both small nose rings and small earrings.
Oh, okay.
Suggests a bit of versatility, maybe reflecting the value of the metal itself. And again, adding turquoise was probably for beauty and that protective element we talked about.
Got it. Then there are these Niello silver bracelets
mm-hmm.
from the Lake Van area with Islamic and floral designs.
Yes, those are quite specific.
Niello, that sounds like a particular technique. What exactly is it?
It is. Niello is it's a decorative technique. You take this black metallic alloy, usually sulfur mixed with silver, copper, maybe lead, and you inlay it into engraved or etched patterns on the metal, like silver here. Then you fire it. The alloy turns black and hardens.
Ah, creating a contrast. Yeah.
Exactly. A really striking contrast with the polished silver. It allows for very intricate designs, like those Islamic and floral motifs on the Lake Van bracelets. That area became quite well known for it around 1900 or so.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
And nose rings were once common enough to appear in folklore, the golden flower nose ring.
Yeah, that mention in folklore really elevates it, doesn't it? It's not just an accessory then. It becomes symbolic, beauty, maybe something deeper culturally within those stories.
Right. Belts, too. Not just functional, but often really ornate buckles.
Definitely.
There's an example of an early 20th century belt from northern Iraq, Ottoman-inspired buckle with a bote motif.
The bote, yes, also known as paisley.
Oh, paisley. Okay. Where does that come from?
It's got a long history, originates in Persia, but was widely used by the Ottomans.
I see.
So seeing it on a northern Iraqi belt really shows that cultural exchange, the artistic influences moving around the region, and the belt itself with appliqué granules.
Granules, those are the tiny metal balls.
Exactly, tiny spheres. And turquoise and coral-colored glass beads on a red cotton band with silver bits. It's a real mix of styles and materials.
Fascinating. Okay, finally in this section, amulets.
Always important.
We have the Nazar, the evil eye bead, which is pretty ubiquitous, and the Taweez, an amulet or locket. But the Shamarran figure is really striking. Half woman, half snake, on pendants, brooches.
Yeah, the Shamarran is fascinating.
Its meaning seems to have shifted over time, hasn't it?
It really has. Traditionally, it was about luck, protection, drawing on old folklore. But more recently,
Yeah.
it's become this powerful symbol of, well, modern Kurdish identity, and particularly linked to women's strength, resilience.
Wow.
It shows how these old symbols can be reinterpreted, take on new life, reflecting current issues, social consciousness.
So the forms are incredibly varied. Let's talk about the materials themselves. The substance of splendor, as our notes say. Precious metals first, gold and silver.
Obvious starting point.
Gold signifies wealth, prestige, heritage, pride, all the expected things. It's interesting that even today, 18K or 24K gold plating is common.
Right. And that continued use, even just plating, really underlines how much cultural value gold still holds.
That aspirational quality.
Exactly. It evokes that sense of heritage, prestige, even if the piece isn't solid gold, still connects to the tradition.
And silver, more accessible, often linked with purity.
Generally, yes. You see this distinction, gold often for the wealthier, silver more common, but it shows that wearing meaningful jewelry wasn't just for the elite.
Right, it was important across the board.
Yep.
And Kurdish goldsmiths, silversmiths, clearly very skilled.
Absolutely. The craftsmanship in both metals points to a long respected history of metalworking in Kurdish communities.
Okay, gemstones. Turquoise seems really important culturally.
It's hugely important.
Seen as a divine blessing, protective. But there's this interesting split. Yarsani Kurds use it a lot, but Yazidi Kurds traditionally avoid it because of its color and Tawusi Melek.
Yes, that's a really key point illustrating the diversity within Kurdish culture.
How so?
Well, for many, that blue means protection, blessings. But for Yazidis, its association with the peacock angel, Tawusi Melek, means it's avoided out of respect.
I see.
Whereas for the Yarsani faith, those positive associations make it significant. So one stone, different meanings for different groups within the broader culture.
That's really insightful. What about coral, often seen with gold, linked to the wealthy, power, protection?
Yes, coral definitely seems to have carried connotations of status and protection.
And carnelian, that goes way back to ancient Mesopotamia, doesn't it?
Right.
Linked to health, luck, protection.
A very ancient connection, yes. Lapis lazuli, too, another ancient trade good, probably quite prized.
Right, and amber, more spiritual symbolism sometimes.
Often, yes. Amber has those associations in many cultures. The variety of stones is really quite striking.
It is. What does that tell us?
It speaks volumes about trade networks over centuries, intermingling cultures. Each stone brought its own symbolism, adding layers of meaning, connecting Kurdish communities to a wider world.
And we shouldn't forget simpler things like glass beads or the faience in the Saba Uyun. Color seems important too. Blue and red come up a lot. Was that just aesthetics?
Unlikely. Colors like blue and red definitely carried symbolic weight. Blue, as we said, protection, heavens. Red often symbolizes vitality, power, courage, maybe joy. Seeing them frequently suggests these meanings were deeply understood.
Okay. Coins again. We touched on them,
yeah.
But their dual role, adornment and wealth, is key.
Very distinctive, yes.
And finding international coins, English sovereigns, Napoleonic coins, Turkish liras, especially in the 19th century, that's amazing.
It really turns the jewelry into tiny historical records, doesn't it?
Right.
Reflecting trade, empires, global interactions.
And the lira motif still appears in contemporary designs.
It does seem to persist. Maybe a nostalgic link to the more recent past. A way to keep a recognizable cultural element in newer designs, tradition adapting.
We also see other materials, wood, wool, leather for jewelry boxes. Some modern artists use natural things like terebinth grains.
Yes, that points to real creativity, resourcefulness.
And that account of hair adorned with silk rosaries.
Right. It shows the tradition goes beyond just metal and stones, incorporating natural elements, crafted items, in really personal ways.
So all these forms and materials come together through the artisan's skill. Let's talk craftsmanship, techniques, filigree, or telkari.
Ah, telkari. Beautiful stuff.
Intricate twisted wires, roots in Mesopotamia. Midyat is famous for it.
Yes, Midyat is a major center. Its reputation comes from generations of metalworkers passing down skills.
It must take incredible skill and patience.
Oh, absolutely. Filigree is so detailed, drawing silver into fine wires, making the frame, shaping tiny motifs, soldering, often adding those little granules too.
It sounds incredibly labor-intensive.
It is. These aren't mass-produced. They're individual pieces of art. Shows real dedication.
Then there's granulation, applying tiny metal spheres. That goes back to Sumerian times.
Way back. Also found in ancient Syria, Fatimid, Egypt, Syria, areas with historical links to Kurdish regions.
Suggests a kind of shared heritage of craftsmanship across the ancient Near East.
It really does. Points to a common pool of metalworking knowledge, shared aesthetics back then. And its appearance suggests these techniques continued over millennia.
What about chasing and repoussé, creating relief designs?
Right. Related techniques. Chasing works from the front. Repoussé from the back, pushing the metal out.
Used by Kurdish goldsmiths in northwest Iran, the sources say. Maybe echoing Sasanian motifs?
It's possible. They'd use these techniques to add depth, texture. Drawing on older traditions like the Sasanians, who were famous for metalwork, makes sense. Shows a continuity of artistic practice.
And yellow, the black inlay we talked about earlier. A specialty around Lake Van for those silver bracelets around 1900.
Exactly. Fascinating how certain areas specialized. That combination of black and yellow, silver, and those Islamic floral motifs created a very distinct regional look.
And there were other techniques too, right? Engraving, stone setting, casting, forging, stamping, embossing.
A whole range of skills.
Inlay generally, which is different from niello.
Yes. Inlay is broader embedding one material into another. Niello is a specific type of inlay using that black alloy. And carving is mentioned, too. Shows the breadth of Kurdish jewelry-making skills.
These pieces are clearly so much more than just pretty objects. They are woven in meaning, as the notes put it.
Absolutely. The symbolism is incredibly rich.
They indicate status, wealth, identity. Gold meaning higher status than silver or base metals.
Mm-hmm.
They're crucial in life events like bride price next and milk money Caleb or Serdin.
Yes. Their role in social customs like bride price really shows how deeply embedded jewelry is in Kurdish society.
And now in modern times, seeing the map of Kurdistan or flag motifs.
That shows the adaptability, using tradition to express collective identity, even political aspirations today.
There's also this strong belief in protective power, apotropaic power.
Right, warring off harm.
Against the evil eye, Nizar, and misfortune. We see it in turquoise, the Nizar bead itself, the Saba Uyun.
Various amulets, too, sometimes called muska or tawiz.
And specific protective motifs, like the burdock,
yeah.
Pitrak, hand figure comb, el, parmak, tarak, even the cross.
Yeah, that belief in protection is a really significant spiritual dimension. Objects offering safeguarding against unseen negative forces.
Let's look closer at some motifs. Celestial symbols seem common. Crescent moon, often with a star. Ancient roots, maybe Ottoman influence. Feminine energy. Romance.
All possible interpretations.
Yep.
It links Kurdish jewelry to a wider regional symbolic language, drawing on shared ideas about the cosmos.
The star itself, happiness, fertility, often six-pointed, meaning wishes.
Those associations are often made, yes.
And the sun, ancient Iranic links,
mm-hmm.
Light, life force, strength.
Definitely strong symbolism there. Each symbol carries layers of meaning within that broader cultural sphere.
floral and vegetal motifs too, inspired by nature. That golden flower nose ring and folklore.
Right.
Fertility themes, maybe echoing Mesopotamia. Could the tree of life, which is big in Kurdish weaving, appear in jewelry too?
It's certainly possible. The connection to nature motifs underscores a close relationship with the environment, life, growth, beauty. And seeing motifs cross over from weaving suggests a shared artistic vocabulary.
Animal motifs are also everywhere. Birds, good luck, the soul, news, strength.
Lots of positive associations with birds, often reflecting migration, connection between realms.
Snakes, regeneration, but also danger, that duality.
Classic snake symbolism, yeah.
And the shamaran, again, evolving from luck to resistance and women's empowerment. Mm. And the ram's horn, fertility, heroism.
It's like a whole bestiary of cultural meaning. These motifs come straight from folklore, embodied deeply held beliefs. And shamaran's evolution is a really potent example of symbols adapting.
We also see geometric patterns, probably influenced by Islamic art.
Very likely, yes, reflecting broader artistic trends in the region.
And motifs borrowed from weaving, hands on hips, a lag lin for motherhood, fertility symbols, barakat, hair bands, sakbagi for wanting marriage, earrings, kupo, representing a marriage gift.
It's fascinating, isn't it? That cross-pollination between weaving and jewelry. It reinforces the cultural meaning, creates a cohesive visual language across different art forms.
Even the materials and colors carry meaning. Gold wealth, sun, silver purity, protection, mm-hmm. turquoise blessings, protection with those Yarsani Yazidi differences, coral vitality, power, protection, carnelian life, courage, luck, protection.
It's a really complex system.
It is. Form, motif, material, color, all communicating something. A very sophisticated visual language reflecting this rich tapestry of beliefs and values.
Absolutely.
And these pieces aren't just symbolic. They have vital social and ceremonial roles. Weddings are a huge one.
Central, really.
Specific pieces like the jerchnaga, those elaborate wedding necklaces showing prosperity. Jewelry's role in bride price, next. Dowry, seyyeches, milk money. Caleb Certain.
It highlights the economic, social, and symbolic weight. It's about uniting individuals, strengthening families, displaying status.
Though rising gold prices are apparently causing some economic strain on these traditions now.
That's a real-world impact. Shows how economic shifts can affect even deeply rooted customs.
Festivals, too, especially Newroz, wearing elaborate jewelry, decorated headpieces. It's a big display of cultural identity, right?
A very powerful public affirmation of Kurdish heritage, connecting with shared identity through these visual symbols.
And there's a difference between everyday wear and ceremonial pieces. Simpler things, daily silver coins, glass beads, small metal bits, nose rings.
Right. More practical for daily life.
Compared to the elaborate gold, gemstones for special occasions or status display. Reflects different contexts.
It does. But even the simpler pieces still carry cultural meaning, personal significance. Adornment remains important.
Okay, definitely time for a quick pause, I think.
Yeah.
Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roji Bosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Roj Bosh.
Let's see. The chai. It's a little bitter today, I think.
Oh, really?
Definitely needs a bit more sugar to balance it out.
Yeah.
But the warmth is welcome. A nice pause in our exploration.
Always welcome. Short pause for the chai break.
Ah, that's better. A little sweetness makes all the difference. Where were we?
We were just about to get into the regional variations, I believe.
Right. Yes. Because even with this shared heritage across Greater Kurdistan, there are definite local flavors.
For sure.
Like in Iraqi Kurdistan, those forehead ornaments with silver chains, crescents, the Sabah-Uyun we mentioned, maybe some Assyrian influences too.
It's possible. And that northern Iraqi belt with the Ottoman buckle we talked about.
So what causes these regional differences? Mm-hmm. Materials, local traditions, influences.
Probably a mix of all those things. Local materials available, artistic traditions developing differently, interaction with neighbors and empires. The Iraqi examples show that blend of core Kurdish elements with Assyrian Ottoman influences.
What about Iranian Kurdistan? Different nuances there.
Seems so. Kermanshah area jewelry apparently clearly showed economic status. Haraman, known for those decorated kilafez hats. Mukarian and Ardalan regions, women liked gold strings on the forehead, valued the Yako gemstone specifically.
Yeah.
Ruby or similar red gem. So very specific regional markers showing local customs, maybe specific trade links for certain stones.
In Turkish Kurdistan. Lake Van area, famous for Niello silverware.
Right. We covered that.
Hakkari region, lots of silver and gold jewelry, elaborate festive headgear. And Mardin and Midyat, the Centers for Telkari Filigree, plus specific DK motifs in Mardin.
Yeah, it seems certain crafts really became concentrated in specific places, like Telkari and Mardin Midyat in Yellow near Lake Van, developed regional artisanal identities, styles, reputations.
Syrian Kurdistan. Sources suggest similarities with Iraqi Kurdistan.
Seems likely, given the cultural ties across the border.
Reports of rigid neck rings with talismans near the border. And Aleppo might have been a production site for some of the elaborate silver head ornaments.
That suggests cross-border connections, yeah. And a major city like Aleppo playing a role makes sense trade. Movement of artisans.
It's interesting contrasting the styles, too. Nomadic or tribal, often lots of coins, bright colors.
Mm-hmm. Maybe more rugged, functional in some ways.
Compared to urban styles, more refined, technically complex, like filigree or niello.
Right. Lifestyle access to resources definitely influenced the look. But as you said, there's still that overarching shared heritage. Core themes, certain motifs pop up across the board, unity within the diversity.
Okay, finally, let's look at today. Contemporary echoes, future directions.
Where things are heading now.
We're seeing modern Kurdish jewelers like Nazca Omar, inspired by nature, mythology, using work for education.
Yes, artists like her are really significant.
And the trend for nationalist symbols, the map, the flag. Plus, commercial brands like Qzon, mixing cultural inspiration with modern fashion, selling online.
It shows the tradition is alive and kicking, adapting. These modern jewelers creatively reinterpret things, use new platforms. It keeps Kurdish jewelry relevant globally.
There are also cultural revival initiatives. The Shamran Revolution, promoting pride. Organizations like Kayseri, preserving heritage. Grassroots efforts by artisans using local stones.
Those efforts are crucial. They help safeguard the heritage, the skills, the meanings, ensure they're passed on, not lost to modernization.
But there are challenges too, surely.
Definitely.
Economic pressures, rising gold prices affecting dowry traditions. Traditional craftsmanship might decline with socioeconomic changes. Competition for mass production.
True. And globalization is a double-edged sword. Opportunities online, but challenges staying distinctive.
How can those be tackled?
It needs a combined approach, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting artisans' training, resources, promoting the cultural value, encouraging contemporary designers to engage with tradition innovatively. Education, cultural awareness are key too. Fostering appreciation.
So as we wrap up our time in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive today, it feels like we've journeyed through this incredibly intricate world. Kurdish jewelry isn't just objects. It's this unbroken thread through history, artistry, deep cultural meaning.
Mm-hmm. They really tell stories. Identity, status, protection, connection to a really rich heritage.
What's captivating is seeing how it continues. From ancient Mesopotamia right up to modern expressions of identity, it's still a vibrant, evolving art form.
Absolutely. That legacy of craftsmanship, the powerful symbolism in each piece, it really highlights how jewelry carries cultural memory.
Well, we certainly hope this conversation has sparked some curiosity for you listening. What other stories might these gleaming pieces hold? What could these traditions tell us about the resilience, the creativity of the Kurdish people?
Definitely things to ponder.
We encourage you to keep exploring this fascinating subject.